The computer that controlled the machine, Skynet, sent two Terminators back through time. Their mission, to stop the author of a book about reproduction rights issues, Michelle Goldberg. The first Terminator was programmed to strike at reproduction rights in the year 1981, before third wave feminism was born. The second was set to become California governor and distract the left from very important issues. It was just a question of which one of the Terminators would stop the conversation first. Okay, so I am here with Michelle Goldberg, who is most recently the author of The Means of Reproduction. Michelle, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic. First off, let's start with a general question about this rather enormous subject. In 1968, Paul Ehrlich, of course, published The Population Bomb, and it predicted mass starvations of millions of citizens in the 1970s and the 1980s. Now, he was absolutely dead on about Africa, but he was mocked for this because it did not necessarily apply to developed countries. And so I'm curious, just to start off here, what do you think would be this kind of Paul Ehrlich-like response to what is a serious problem that's often swept under the rug? You allude later in the book to the fact that the declining birth rates in Europe seem to have ushered in a similar kind of reaction, a similar kind of importance to this particular issue, but what of this?
Well, Paul Ehrlich actually did a lot of damage by making these very hyperbolic predictions, by predicting that we were about to, you know, enter this kind of apocalyptic Malthusian world in which the planet's population was going to kind of cannibalize itself. And he made these predictions. And there was a couple of things. I mean, partly you just don't, it's never a good idea to predict the end of the world. Those people always end up being discredited until eventually someone's going to be right. But and then there are two other parts of it. One part is that this was actually not just because of Paul Ehrlich, but the entire panic over overpopulation was the very rare example of a massive global problem that people really mobilized in response to. So there really was this unbelievable, and a lot of my book is about the kind of unbelievable mobilization worldwide to bring down birth rates, to distribute contraceptives, to create this kind of revolution, you know, not just in terms of commodities, but in terms of behavior and desired family size. There was also a green revolution, which really revolutionized agriculture. And so a lot of the predicted calamities didn't come to pass because they were addressed. And so now we're in a point where, in part because of the both because of the hyperbole of Ehrlich's prediction, because of the overreaction to it, which sometimes led to coercion, and because of the widespread sense that Ehrlich has been discredited, and also, as you mentioned, because of the fear about population decline in Europe, it's become incredibly difficult and taboo in a whole variety of movements to even talk about population as a problem. And that's just starting to crack. I get the sense that there's just now a kind of reawakened debate and discussion about overpopulation as a problem. You know, people realize that we are going to have more than well over 9 billion people within the next 40 years, and no prospect right now of having the resources to support them all.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about European birth rates. You point out, for example, that if Italy's 1995 fertility rate remained constant, that without immigration, the country would have the population it has now. 100 years from now, it would be 14% of that population. I mean, that's a really, really significant figure. And the United States only has a slightly higher birth rate than Europe in this kind of scenario. America, though, is one of only four countries that does not have any paid leave for mothers in the workforce. And you point out that the way of ensuring a higher birth rate would be by promoting mothers working and the like. But I'm wondering, likewise, what other factors there might have to be to keep these birth rates high. It can't just be predicated on this, because there's also scenarios involving the Muslim population, and of course, when we get into multiculturalism, it then becomes this entire ball of wax. Would you say that the primary concern for keeping the birth rate at an acceptable and a healthy level for each particular country would involve this notion of ensuring greater rights for women, greater implementation of those rights into the workforce? Or are we dealing with a situation in which possibly in exacting those particular rights, we may very well be in this kind of racial fragmentation as opposed to this ethnic integration?
This is a really complicated question, and you kind of have to break it in half. Like, let's put the United States aside for a moment, because the United States is an exception for important and interesting reasons. But if we just want to discuss kind of the United States aside, what's happening right now in every developed country, say, except for the United States, once countries reach a certain level, it used to be that people believed that you could bring down birth rates and that they would stabilize at around 2.1, which is replacement fertility. You know, that kind of assumes that a certain number of children are going to die. That's how you replace a population, 2.1 children per woman. And people assumed at one point that birth rates would I don't really know why they assumed that. I guess it just seemed rational. But that's not what's happened. So in every single country, all over the developed world, birth rates are going below 2.1 and some points quite below 2.1. So that in Italy, Poland, Spain, Japan, Singapore, Russia, you have very, very low birth rates, the kind of birth rates that, you know, threaten the future of the culture. And you can't necessarily, although immigration is part of the answer, and in a perfect world would be the whole of the answer, you can't expect Italy to, say, replace 84% of its population with immigrants without having some serious upheaval and nationalist backlashes. Yeah. And, you know, there's just no human society that can adjust to its own kind of obsolescence without some kind of internal upheavals. And so this is something that the right has really seized on. You know, there's all of these right-wing books about, you know, the death of the West and demographic winter. And, you know, these books are constantly accusing feminism of being a harbinger of the death of its own civilization. And it's both tied up with a panic about women and not having enough babies. And also it's tied up with a panic, particularly in Europe, about Islam and they're outbreeding us. And, you know, we're going to turn into Eurabia. And so far, the left wing hasn't really addressed it at all, for obvious reasons, I think. It's a very tricky, explosive subject. And so what the right wing analysis has totally missed in blaming feminism for all this is that it's the countries that have these really catastrophically, that's probably too strong a word, the countries that have these really dangerously declining birth rates are inevitably the countries that have progressed a lot economically, industrially, materially, but have not had similar progression kind of socially. So that men, there's still the kind of patriarchal gender roles within the family. There's still very little government support for working mothers. There's, you know, no paid daycare, or there's very little daycare. There's very little family leave. There's very little job flexibility. So essentially, there's no kind of social structures available for women to integrate work and family life. And so a great many women are choosing not to give birth if giving birth is going to mean sticking them in a role to which that they're no longer willing to play, a subservient role that they're no longer willing to play. Countries like Sweden, Denmark, France, Norway that have a whole suite of supports for working women have birth rates that are, well, not that are just under replacement, which is manageable. There's like a huge, you know, in these kind of demographic predictions, the difference between a birth rate of 1.8 and 1.3 is actually quite stark in terms of what it's going to look like 100 years hence. So the other thing is that this fear about kind of Muslims overtaking Europe is also in many cases really overstated. I mean, you have a relatively big Muslim population in France. It's infinitesimal in most of the rest of the continent. And Muslim birth rates are also going down, you know, although there's a lag because they're not, you know, because like most people who are economically disenfranchised have more children. But, you know, Muslim birth rates are also going down. The birth rates of the countries surrounding Europe, you know, Turkey, Tunisia, those countries are look more like Europe than they do like Africa. So then let's take the United States, because the United States is the country that the right likes to point to as an example of, well, no, what you really need is faith in God and faith in a creator, and that's the only thing that'll sustain a society. And, you know, that's something Mitt Romney was talking about in some of his last speeches. And there's a little bit of truth to that. Well, part of it is the United States has replacement fertility because of Hispanic immigration. You know, so if we didn't have Hispanic immigration, our birth rate would look more like France. But even that's pretty good. So why do we have a birth rate as high as France without, you know, the kind of social policies that France has for working women? Sure, part of that is religiosity, right? And religiosity for two reasons. Both because we have, you know, the highest birth rate in the country is in Utah. Also, religiosity in terms of religiosity has something to do with our kind of abysmal sex ed and our much higher rates of teen pregnancy than any other civilized country.
Go USA!
And then there's also something that I find really fascinating and kind of totally counterintuitive, which is that there's some economists and sociologists who've looked at this and say that, you know, actually, women here are... there actually is more support for working women in the United States than there is, for example, in Germany. And that's something I don't think we realize. And it's for a couple of reasons. Part of it is because our high rates of illegal immigration creates, you know, kind of a class of nannies that subsidizes the work of middle-income women. This is not an ideal situation, but this is part of what exists. The other thing is that women, because our job market and our economic system is so incredibly... insecure for everyone, because there is no kind of lifetime employment anymore. And whereas in Germany, you know, if you're on this kind of upwardly mobile track, you can pay a huge price for stepping off that for a few years to raise children. There's no getting back on an equivalent level. You have to start from ground zero again in terms of building your pension and all the rest. The United States, we don't have that. Everybody's insecure. Women might have to take off a year or two to raise children, but men are getting laid off all the time. And so some of these economists said, you know, women's insecurity has less of a cost when everyone is insecure. And then the final piece of that is just that the labor market here is women here work more than they do in many, many other countries, you know, so women here have been able to combine work and family in a more ad hoc and more insecure way than in Europe. But we're not an exception to the rule that places where that allow women to combine work and family have higher birth rates than modern industrialized country that do not.
But what do we say to the acolytes of the mommy wars, the Caitlin Flanagans who insist that women must stay home and must not work and must take care of their children and have this essential luxury, when in fact the statistics that we're talking about here have a very positive correlation between the ability to increase the birth rate and also the ability to keep women working? So what is the solution? How do we get them off of this track, which is 180 from what the statistics are?
Well, I would say, I mean, it's difficult because this isn't a really salient issue in the United States. Nobody in the United States is really panicking about the birth rate in the way that they are in Europe. Yeah. So to say, well, you need to do this in order to kind of, you know, keep our population growing, it's not something that's part of the debate. I would only say that, again, that women are in places where women are forced to choose between work and family, we're seeing that they will very often choose work. You know, and so all of the evidence out there shows that women are happier and better adjusted and will go to kind of quite extraordinary lengths to keep one foot in the adult world.
Got it. Well, I also wanted to bring up the sex selection abortion problem in India, in which boys are prioritized over girls thanks to the ubiquity of ultrasound. Suddenly, the cultural value in which girls are declared lesser than boys becomes a reality. And now we have ourselves a situation in which parents, now the notion of what pro-life means drastically changes. Parents now are in the position of being able to choose, well, oh, I can keep this baby if he's a boy, and I can kill the baby if he's a girl. And now anyone who is interested in this particular issue is now on the exact same side of the argument as a pro-lifer who is encouraging a woman to have this, you know, who's against this woman of having choice. And yet, simultaneously, we are talking about individual choice here. So how do we corral these two in a way so that everybody understands what's at stake here, that this is a very damaging issue when we talk about the boy-to-girl ratio in India?
Well, it's difficult, and part of what I kind of... I don't necessarily see all these ideals as being reconcilable. I also don't really think it's the job. I think I write in the book, it's not really the job of Indian feminists to graft their issues onto the kind of ideological contours of our debates in the United States, right? There is, for all intents and purposes, no anti-abortion movement in India.
Yeah.
It's just not, and which is itself kind of a fascinating thing. And I suspect that the reason there's no anti-abortion movement in India is because abortion was legalized as a method of population control, in the context of population control, rather in the context of women's liberation. So it didn't really threaten any established social structures, but that's a digression. A couple of things. India, this is a huge problem, and it's a huge problem in part because, as I was saying before, you know, the world mobilized in the face of this perceived threat of massive overpopulation. But it didn't address the root cause. I mean, the main argument of my book is that the root cause of all of these imbalances is the oppression of women. I think it's absolutely fascinating that improving the options and the power and the autonomy of women will simultaneously address overpopulation and population decline and these distorted sex ratios. But of course, that's not what they did in India. They, you know, sometimes with coercion, sometimes with quotas, often just with like a barrage of PR, they succeeded over many decades in changing people's ideas of desired family size. And it wasn't just the government. It was also urbanization and all sorts of things.
And cultural values, too.
Right. But this happened without any kind of concomitant attempt to change gender roles. So people decided, yes, I don't want six kids. We want two kids. Or we want one kid. And it has to be a boy. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so you've replaced basically one demographic emergency in India with another. And women, the feminist movement in India is extraordinarily concerned about this. And it's interesting when you go there as an American feminist, because the language shades so easily into the language of the American anti-abortion movement.
Yeah.
Right? They talk about female feticide. And actually, the Hindi word that they use literally translates as the killing of young girls. You know, there's protests against this. There's really an attempt to ban, well, not an attempt. They've banned ultrasound. They're demanding greater crackdowns on ultrasound. So yes, they are very much against the right of women to make this choice. And it would be kind of comfortable if we could say, well, women aren't really making these choices. They're being forced into it. And sometimes they are. You know, I interview women in this book who are absolutely forced to have multiple abortions by sadistic partners and their mother-in-laws because they kept getting pregnant with girls. Nevertheless, there's also, you know, kind of rich, educated, seemingly liberated women who, you know, share the values of their culture as most people do and are absolutely determined to have sons and, you know, to demand abortions from their gynecologists when they get pregnant with daughters. And what I would, choice is just not as salient an issue in the Indian context, in part because feminists there have been fighting against all kinds of cultural practices framed as choices, right? They fight against the choice of a woman to fling herself on her husband's funeral pyre. You know, they fight against the choice of parents to pay huge dowries to marry off their girls. And so, you know, what one woman said to me was that, you know, often the fact that a woman is making a choice reflects the fact that she has very few rights. And again, ultimately, I don't know that these two things are that their kind of cosmology or, you know, that their battles and ours are totally reconcilable. I do think it presents, you know, real contradictions, you know, for someone, for a pro-choice person like myself. I also tend to find that the overriding kind of guiding principle of this book is one of solidarity with women who are working to advance their own rights in kind of radically different cultural conditions.
You use the words, the modifier, seemingly liberated to describe this educated Indian woman who goes and, of her own volition, says, I want to have boys, I don't want to have girls. And let's actually take this into consideration along with, for example, the case of Fumbai Amadou, mm-hmm. who would feel very much insulted by the notion that she is not empowered. Here is someone who has been circumcised and who finds the notion of being mutilated, that particular verb applied to her, very gravely offensive. So now we're dealing with a scenario in which, if we are trying to talk about broader problems like reproduction and reproduction rights, we are also talking about having to deal with people who have values that are, I suppose, are 180 from us, and simultaneously try to get through to them. But now we're in a situation in which we have to go ahead and find some sort of, I guess, Venn diagram of how we talk to them. And if you think that these are not reconcilable, as you suggested in your two answers ago, I must point out some problems with this overall thesis, because if we cannot communicate to these people, if we cannot respect the rights in a cultural relativist kind of way of these people to make decisions that are converse to pro-choice, that are converse to women's rights, at least as they are established in our country, how then do we find common ground here?
Well, I'm not saying that we can't discuss them, or that I'm saying that I don't think it's always, or maybe it's just beyond me, to create some kind of absolutist system in which we can elucidate and create a hierarchy of what falls under the categories of universal human rights, what is multiculturalism, how we value the right of people to perpetuate their own cultural practices versus the rights of minorities to, or, you know, versus the rights of kind of dissidents to be protected by universal human right guarantees. I clearly over and over again tend to side with people who say, with people, minorities who do demand to be protected by the kind of same universal human rights guarantees that I cherish. I'm not particularly sympathetic to multiculturalist or relativistic arguments as opposed to universal kind of enlightenment type arguments. But I guess what I'm saying is that this book, you know, this book is about, is full of, I'm often interested in the ambiguities and the kind of hard questions and the human stories in which it's not as easy to sort out this hierarchy of values. You know, I'm not like a philosopher like Martha Nussbaum, who has created this very rigorous and well thought out kind of taxonomy of these different issues.
I guess, though, the question here is, like, when, say, Eve Ensler goes to Kenya and gives a V-Day Jeep to Agnes Pareo, is there not something, I suppose, imperialistic about that notion of basically taking our particular values and stamping them onto another country that doesn't necessarily reflect this? This is really what the problem is in terms of also your complaints about the Cairo conference, the UN convention, in which you complain about the Vatican, and you point out, well, it's a country of 1,000 people, mostly celibate men. Nevertheless, it is a country. Nevertheless, we do have to have some sort of communicative process. I mean, what I guess the question is what conditions would seem to be fair to present these messages in a way that don't feel imperialist, or that don't encroach upon these terms that we may consider here in America to be somewhat terrible or pejorative or just really just against our notion of human rights, and what someone else considers to be, well, this is my form of empowerment, this is the way that I go about the universe.
Well, let's back up and just explain what we're talking about here, right? We're talking about, in the context of Agnes Pareo, yeah, and Fumbai Amadou, we're talking about female genital cutting or female circumcision. Fumbai Amadou is a woman in this book who is from Sierra Leone, who undergoes circumcision as an adult, who is someone who talks about it being, you know, a valuable part of her cultural identity, who is probably the most kind of eloquent defender of the practice on the global stage, in part because the people, although it's clearly very valued in these societies, otherwise, you know, people wouldn't fight so hard to keep the practice alive. The people who genuinely practice and aren't people who have a lot of access to NGOs and the media and et cetera. So I think she's an important voice. At the same time, I think that the question of whether Eve Ensler is being imperialistic by supporting these women in Kenya who are fighting female genital cutting. I don't know. I mean, to me, that's not that interesting. And it's not some. And I think if you brought that up with Agnes Pareo, who is someone who's from the community that practices this, who underwent it herself, who's regretted it her whole life, who was a grassroots activist against it, who, you know, was girls were kind of running away from home to escape this practice, and she was finding the places to stay and enrolling them in school, and then finally met Eventzler, and Eventzler started to support her. I think that the question of, well, is it imperialist to support Agnes Pareo is kind of insulting to her, because she has just as much right to she's just as authentic a voice for her community. She has just as much right to try to change and kind of create progress in her community as we have to create progress in ours. And I think that to a certain extent, once you say that, well, the only authentic voices in a developing country are the kind of most traditional and most static and most unchanging, you're arrogating the whole concept of progress and human rights to the West, right? Nobody, no kind of American feminist ever worries that they're undermining our own society or making our society any less authentic because we expand the rights for half of the people in it.
Let me clarify where I'm coming from, because I find this to be a very interesting notion. I mean, I'm all for what Eve Ensler is doing, but I am pointing out this notion of cultural relativism in light of what you point out early in the book with Reimard Ravenholt, where you point out his program to get contraceptives in Pakistan. He had the idea of comparing it to Coca-Cola, in the sense that the people get the contraceptives, they figure out what to do with them, they figure out how to distribute them, and that notion of aid becomes something that is, I suppose, less imperialistic in the way it disseminates the contraceptives versus outright giving someone a Jeep and giving someone the money. Because you need, over the course of time, you need concepts to disseminate and figure out a way for them to essentially spread throughout the course of a country, so that attitudes eventually change.
But to me, the big difference, there would be a huge difference between Eve Ensler coming into Kenya and saying, I'm going to build a shelter so girls can run away from home to escape this practice. To me, that's a huge thing. That's a very different thing than saying, I'm going to support a woman who has been working, you know, within her own culture, within her own kind of cultural context, you know, who's already started this process, and I'm just going to come and support her. That's a very different thing. And one of the things I try to point out in this book is that there is no such thing as a kind of, there's no such thing as cultural purity or real cultural authenticity. Actually, the forces and the case of female genital mutilation or female genital cutting is an exception in that there, except for some places where there's support from the Islamic community, there's not generally kind of international support for that practice. But in many cases, you have, just as you have feminists and women's rights activists supporting their allies on the ground, you also have international alliances of conservatives supporting their own allies, you know, so that you have, you know, the Saudi Arabian monarchy pumping lots of money into very, very conservative mosques and Islamic movements all over the world, you know, likewise for Iran, likewise at times for the United States government, and certainly for the American evangelical movement, which has significant allies across the globe, you know, especially in Africa, where kind of Pentecostalism, American style is exploding. You have obviously the Vatican. And often, though, it's only the kind of women's rights people and the only the feminists who are accused of cultural imperialism and cultural subversion. The most conservative forces, even when they are getting international support, even when they're attending international conferences on how to stave off the march of feminism, which is something else, you know, I describe one of these conferences in the book, they still will pose as the kind of authentic grassroots defenders of traditional culture against this steamroller of globalization.
I also want to talk about the global gag rule, because I think it's important, in which the United States refuses to fund any organization that performs or discusses abortion. It's flip-flopped dramatically over the last five presidents. But as a result, money that is very important, that actually keeps many of these efforts alive in other countries, is lopped off, and progress constantly occurs and then is stopped and then occurs and then is stopped. And it's this constant game of inching one's way forward only to have one's legs lopped off. And so the question is, because there is this association in the American conservative mindset that abortion or that reproductive rights equals abortion. And we do have some people, as you point out, during his days in the UN, the first George Bush actually was very much a reproductive rights man.
Well, he wasn't he was a population control
man. Right. He was a little bit better than his son.
Certainly.
But the question is what do we do to essentially communicate to these conservatives that there is a significant problem here and that efforts like this are completely disrespectful and in light of keeping progress going and keeping this population control problem going? I mean, do we reach out to people like George Bush Sr., or what's the deal here?
Well, I don't know that you can reach out to all conservatives because we actually don't have the same goals. You know, there's no point in saying to certain people on the religious right that we need to expand reproductive rights because it supports women's autonomy in all kinds of other ways, you know, because it's a crucial tool for development. Even the argument occasionally that we need to improve reproductive health care, family planning, sex education, because it is the best way to reduce abortion. That works with some people, certainly. That works with certain, you know, anti-abortion people of good faith. But it doesn't necessarily work with those who oppose abortion because they oppose the sexual revolution, because they oppose this, because they see abortion as a sign, as a kind of broader sign of galloping libertinism, and you know, so, and who are more important with preserving certain kind of archaic norms than they are with addressing the messiness of human reality. So you can't talk to everyone, you know, you're not going to convince everyone. The people who are reachable, I think, again, are anti-abortion activists of good faith who are genuinely morally troubled by abortion and could be convinced by real empirical data that the best way to reduce abortion is not to make it illegal, but to protect women so that they don't need to have recourse to it as often. You know, I think that we can make the argument that women all over the world deserve abortion rates as low as Western Europe, which has the lowest abortion rate in the world because of all these reasons. The highest abortion rates in the world are in Latin America and East Africa, both places that have very, very, very strict anti-abortion laws, which end up resulting in just very high rates of abortion-related mortality. You know, half of the women who die around the world every year from unsafe abortion are in Africa. And stricter legislation is not going to do it. Stricter legislation is killing them. And then finally, I do think that maybe there are among the right, although less than there used to be, some remnant of the old kind of national security realist types. You know, you had Michael Hayden of the CIA giving speeches towards the end of George Bush's term about the coming dangers of overpopulation. And so, just as the population control movement initially had a lot of its most devoted partisans on the right, you know, it was very much kind of these cold warriors who believed that demographic chaos was going, you know, that overpopulation was going to create so much misery in the developing world that it was going to foment communist revolution. And so you had these, you know, kind of strange Lovian types who were very, very concerned with getting contraception all over the world. I think there might be some residual constituency for that among conservatives concerned about national security and international stability.
Well, you write in this book that religious conservatives around the world have more in common with each other than they do feminists within their own particular societies. This leads me to wonder whether there is even the possibility of some kind of consensus, even a conditional consensus on the topic of abortion, where you have abortion in the event of rape or molestation or whatnot. I mean, this is still, I suppose, some step forward. It's not the ideal step that a pro-choice person would want, but nevertheless, it is small steps forward. So I'm wondering, where does the consensus begin? I mean, I don't think I agree with you entirely with this particular statement, because in the act of any kind of diplomacy, there are always points that people can agree upon. In fact, as frustrating as one of the UN conventions that you describe, you do show that that the Iraqi ambassador ended up being able to change one portion of this Iranian managed to change one clause. So yeah, that was a pain in the ass, but nevertheless, it was progress in some sense.
Well, I'm not sure. I think you're conflating two different things. I mean, on the one hand, you're saying, as I say, that fundamentalists around the world have more in common with each other than they do with liberals in their own society. And then it doesn't necessarily follow from that progress and points of consensus are not possible. You know, I don't think you'll ever have ultimately a consensus over abortion. I don't think you'll ultimately have a consensus over women's rights. I mean, except in a kind of radically egalitarian country like Sweden, which is, you know, one of the very few places in the world where they've managed to come to a genuine social consensus on women's rights. This, you know, often strikes the very heart of how a society is organized. And it's no surprise that it arouses the kind of most intense passions. It's, you know, the kind of most visible sign of globalization. It's the most visible sign of modernization. It's the most visible sign of the passing of one order and the coming of another.
But you want to talk about consensus. Let's talk about the UN Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. This is one thing in which Sudan, Somalia, Iraq, Qatar, and the United States have a common position in. So this leads me to wonder also whether even a UN convention, yes, it may have some effect in a Tanzanian court, as you point out, but is this a sort of country-by-country basis? I mean, here in America, would a UN protocol really have any effect on our ability to recognize discrimination against women?
No. These UN things don't matter so much in the United States. The reason that it matters that the United States ratify CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, is because it would give it more authority in other countries, because it gives it the imprimatur of the largest and still most powerful country in the entire world. And one of the things I tried to show in this book is that a lot of these conventions, conferences, declarations, you know, decisions of international courts, it can be incredibly amorphous and it can seem somewhat irrelevant. You know, there's such a kind of yawning chasm between the declarations of international human rights tribunals and the actual reality on the ground. Nevertheless, there are real places where you can point to a kind of straight line between the signing of this convention or the promulgation of, you know, a certain decision at the United Nations Human Rights Commission or elsewhere. There are places where you can say this happened, and as a result, in a village in Kenya or a city in Nicaragua, this person's life was changed. And I give several examples of CEDAW. And it's, again, it's difficult to see from the United States because we don't take international law that seriously.
Yeah.
But other people really do. You know, other countries really do, for a variety of different reasons. Some of them because they believe in it, some because they want very much to be seen as a member in good standing of the global community. There are issues also of kind of imperialism and democracy here. You know, countries that are dependent on aid and trade and the goodwill of other countries are going to be more responsive to international institutions.
But if the international law has no effect on us here, what then would get us to, say, consider something like the Equal Rights Amendment again? Or gets, I mean, and incidentally, the CEDAW was in fact kickstarted by the U.S. It was drafted by the U.S. Representatives. So this is a rather interesting shift that we're not even part of this convention. It's despicable, I would say. I mean, and so what is the way, I suppose, to get us considering these particular issues? I mean, do you believe that really it was Reagan who essentially put an end to this particular debate? Are we coming back
to it right now? Will it take something like a plummeting birth rate here in order for us to really, hey, we should probably consider how we treat our women, you know?
Well, I think that there's a couple of different things. It wasn't just Reagan, it was the rise of the religious right generally, and the fact that the religious right started looking abroad for victories. You know, in many cases, it was easier for politicians to reward the right with gains in foreign policy than it was domestically for the same reason. Nobody pays that much attention to it. You know, the United States could do much more to appease anti-abortion forces abroad in terms of how we structured our foreign policy, because nobody was really, it didn't really affect American women, and thus it didn't really affect American votes that much. In terms of what it would take to, say, kickstart the Equal Rights Amendment, that's a difficult question, in part because we're at a point right now where women are coming to, you know, women are soon going to be the majority of the workforce if they're not already. And I think that that can have a number of different effects. On the one hand, it can perhaps convince people that finally, you know, that women's rights are kind of more integral to the health of the entire society, which is something that we've always known, but something that might become more and more obvious to people as their actual family livelihoods increasingly depend on it. You know, perhaps a family that has one income that's just the woman's income, perhaps a husband in such a family might suddenly be concerned that women only make 80% of what men make. That's one possibility. Another possibility, though, is that this is just going to lead to a kind of massive right-wing backlash as men feel increasingly emasculated.
Yeah. Well, they also may feel emasculated because right now the data is that women are getting more degrees in college and bachelor's and master's So this is a situation I think that is going to eventually play out. I mean, I guess the question also is to what degree can we really anticipate these particular problems? I mean, going back to... in fact, I wanted to go back to Ravenholt mm-hmm. and his efforts in Pakistan. I wonder if you think it was fair for the Carter administration and other FAT forces to essentially kind of admonish him for what wasn't happening in 1976, or whether it is necessary on some level to consider a kind of long-form progress, even a kind of ineffectual progress over the course of numerous years, because these things require long epochs of time before we finally see what happens.
Well, they do and they don't. I mean, I think that Ray Ravenholt is a very interesting figure. He was, you know, the progenitor of the American Population Program. I suppose progenitor is probably an appropriate word. he was this kind of, in certain ways, a kind of a mad genius. He was incredibly audacious, incredibly abrasive, loved to offend people, had like very little respect for anyone's cultural sensibilities, had some innovations that were really brilliant and life-saving and others that were really wacky and absurd. He's this like kind of very interesting, larger-than-life character who managed in a very unique fashion to make incredibly fierce enemies on both the religious right and the feminist left, which ultimately doomed him once Carter came into office. And so I don't think that it's fair to... His legacy is a mixed one and has to be judged as a mixed one. You know, I don't think he can be unilaterally condemned. I also don't think that, you know, there's real problems with what he did. And in terms of Pakistan... You know, Pakistan is a place where the U.S. Strategy of just inundating people with contraceptives really failed. And so is it fair to judge that a failure? I think it is, especially when you compare it to Bangladesh. I mean, Pakistan and Bangladesh are two very different cultures. That's why they fought a civil war. Nevertheless, it's at least instructive to look at why Bangladesh was able to make such greater strides than Pakistan in terms of improving reproductive health, you know, lowering its birth rate, all these other things. And it has, again, Bengal is, you know, in many ways a kind of more progressive culture than the culture of the Punjab. It's very difficult to make these massive cross-cultural comparisons. But we can look at the fact that various programs in Bangladesh, from BRAC to the famous Grameen Bank to all the combined an emphasis on family planning with an emphasis on microfinance and women's empowerment and women's education. And it's when we see all of those things in concert that you make real progress. You know, just kind of airdrops of condoms alone aren't going to do it.
Yeah. But also, I would argue possibly that it's also the way in which the message is communicated. You take to task, quite rightly, many of the sophists such as Julian Simon, who managed to not only disseminate rather generalist arguments about reproductive rights and the population progress, but also managed to talk their way into sinecures within the Reagan administration, which is quite interesting. Nevertheless, I must wonder whether those who are on the reproductive rights, the pro-reproductive rights side, should be taken to task for not considering the fact that, well, Simon, who wasn't entirely bad, did in fact find a way to synthesize a rather complicated issue and present it to the public. And I'm wondering if we want to get into George Lakoff territory, if this is really what it will take to get the word spread around the world, that we will require some kind of message that articulates it all in that I guess Simon-esque manner, but predicated on a more reasonable understanding of the issues.
Well, I would say that Simon actually deserves a lot less credit than that. I mean, I think that what he did was synthesize a huge amount of data and then spit it out in terms of completely comforting fallacies. I mean, he didn't synthesize it so much as he just, I don't know if it can be considered a synthesis when the result of it is so incredibly, when the result is so incredibly fallacious. I mean, he synthesized it in the same way that a global warming denier synthesizes, you know, the massive amounts of data out there. It was total pseudoscience. He was certainly right in criticizing, as I said, the hyperbole of Paul Ehrlich, but his ultimate, you know, kind of, which some people called supply side demography, his ultimate conclusion that there is that natural resources are completely inexhaustible, and that because human ingenuity is the greatest driver of wealth and development, more people equals more ingenuity equals more wealth ad infinitum. Thus, there's no, kind of limits to growth. There's no limit that thus to even talk about overpopulation is, somehow kind of both anti-human and anti-development. I mean, it just has no basis. There's just no... it was an incredibly destructive idea that was incredibly appealing to certain Republican policy elites for a whole bunch of different reasons, because they were opposed to the United Nations, because they were opposed to family planning, because they were opposed to anything that smacked of social engineering. But so it was, you know, an ideology that allowed them to kind of reconcile all these different things that they were opposed to, but it was not... It wasn't right, you know, it wasn't right, and it led to a lot of really destructive policy decisions.
But he did play into the demagoguery of the time, and I guess my question is more along the lines of really, is the only way to really get the issue out to consider the values that are celebrated during any particular epoch, because they're always subject to change, and they're always subject to whatever election sweeps a certain range of people out or into office?
Well, I would say, I mean, it's interesting. I've actually been having this discussion with some people about Paul Ehrlich. You know, was he, on the one hand, Paul Ehrlich, as I said, I think he did a lot of damage. On the other hand, during the 60s, population growth and overpopulation and family planning and the birth rate were subjects of major public discussion in a way that they are absolutely not today. You know, they were absolutely, you know, kind of on the agenda in the same way that, say, global warming is on the agenda right now. Would it have gotten on the agenda with a more considered, nuanced, subtle kind of account? I have no idea. And it's, in certain ways, that's why journalists don't necessarily make the best advocates, or why there's an essential tension between being a journalist and being an activist, because sometimes often there's a gap between what's true and what's useful.
Well, Michelle, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
All those days, wasting time, we used to spend around.